Thank you so much for listening. I'm especially thank you that these people have been gotten here today. Very much hope for anybody else who's on their way that you just get them here safely. And but I just ask that you meet us here this morning. And just thank you for Dr. Dolphin and just taking his time out of a Saturday morning to come meet with us and to teach us more about you, God. So I just pray that you will be with us during this time and just help us to focus and to learn more about you and in your word. So I pray all these things in your son's name. Amen.
The Song of Solomon is this love story between Solomon and the Shulamite, and we can see right away immediately the men and women are not exactly the same. Men and women differ in body and in soul, but not in spirit.
So that's the difference.
That's the difference, yeah. Men and women are alike in spirit. We're alike in spirit, which means our response to God is identical. In fact, in spirit, all of us are the bride of Christ. All of us are the receivers, the beloved of the Lord. Women are deeper in emotions and emotionally more sensitive than men. And
amen to that.
And more intuitive, and their priorities in life differ from those of the man. We see that already here. Hi. We already see that in the behavior of the woman, the Shulamite, and the versus the lifestyle, what the king's doing. The Shulamite is interested in home and garden and family and nurturing and obviously the king is a warrior. He's an adventurer. He's gone a lot. We've kind of seen that. We've seen the interaction between the two of them, in which the king is a picture of Jesus for us, and the queen is a picture of the believer who would like to have a more intimate relationship with Jesus and seeks after him and is caught up in an intimate, exciting relationship with the Lord, which is more than she bargained for. And so this is a beautiful picture of a very close, intimate relationship with Jesus, and with Jesus as our lover, and we as the beloved, learning to respond to his love. The daughters of Jerusalem are a company of young women who, you could say, were nominal believers. This Shulamite maiden was once one of the daughters of Jerusalem. They're like the ladies of waiting, in waiting for the queen. Solomon is the king, and Shulamite is the queen, and their relationship starts very simple because she's a simple girl from the desert and has very little to bring, and yet the king loves her from the beginning and immediately takes her into his palace. In chapter, and we can see all the beautiful images of their relationship being new, being green, being fragrant, being beautiful. She is compared to a lily in a thorn patch in the beauty of her love. And he is, in the end of chapter 3, we had him as the king leading a great army of 60 mighty warriors coming in out of the desert from a long journey, the caravan. In chapter 3, we had an episode in which the king was gone for quite a long time. On my beds by night, I sought him whom my soul loved. I called him, but he gave no answer. So that would be one of those seasons in life when we don't feel close to the Lord, when God seems to have forsaken us, when we have to just keep on going through the ordinary things of life, but our lover is gone. And then we saw that she had a panic attack after a while, and she began to get desperate, and like we would, I've lost my salvation, or God's forgotten me. And she panics and runs out into the streets, and the watchmen of Jerusalem find her, and she runs up and says, "Have you seen him whom my soul loved? Where's the king?" And of course the watchmen are taken aback by that, because that's a surprise. She should know that he's out on a journey. Fortunately, while she's running around looking for him, he shows up. She overreacts by taking him possessively to her mother's house. In other words, I'm never going to let you go. Now that you're back, we're never going to be parted again. I'm never going to let you leave me ever. Which is what happens in any kind of love affair or close relationship is possessiveness and wanting to control it, particularly out of insecurity. And her greatest sense of identity is in her mother's house, but no man wants to be taken prisoner of his mother-in-law. Obviously. And so this is yet another one of the episodes in the Song of Solomon in which she wakes up and realizes that she's lovesick. And that this will happen several times to her, so she turns to the daughter of Jerusalem. By the gazelles and the hinds of the field, I adjure you to stir not up nor awaken love until it please. In other words, this relationship called love is fast-moving and swift and powerful and takes you further than you wanted to go. And you get more than you bargained for when you get into a real relationship of love. You get the good times and the bad times. You get suffering and trial, and you get delight and ecstasy and fellowship, and you're getting them all. And it's very easy to get emotionally overloaded, either emotionally high and then come crashing down the day after, or periods of intense aloneness when you don't feel close to God, or you don't feel, two people in love don't feel like they're communicating, or they feel the old light spark is gone. All those things happen in a relationship. So she passes that advice on. At the end of chapter 3, the queen looks out on the walls of Jerusalem and sees the king returning with 60 mighty men with swords. Every man with a sword at his thigh against alarms by night. So the king is protecting Jerusalem and protecting his bride from all enemies. And he's busy with spiritual warfare and busy with the work of God in the world, and so that's one of the reasons that he's not always right there at the side of his queen. And the interesting thing at the end of chapter 3 was that when he's returning to Jerusalem, he's crowned with the crown which his mother gave him on the day of his wedding. And we talked about that every mother has to give up her son in order for the son to be free to be married. And similarly, that's also true for a woman too, but it's more so for a man. So Solomon has a crown that his mother gave him, and that signifies her approval and her endorsement of his life and her turning him over to God, kind of thing, I think. You can disagree with me and argue. Chapter 4. The king has been gone a long time. She had this panic attack at this time of great loneliness. He comes back at the head of a great army from a great battle. And guess what the first things he says to her when he sees his long-lost love? He doesn't say, who are your name? What's your name? Did we meet before? You certainly looked like a nice girl. We had a good acquaintance. Sometimes. Does he say that? No, he doesn't. He says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. He said that to her the very first time he met her, which is very nice. That's what God says to us the very first time we meet him, is he says, I love you. I accept you as you are. I want you in my family. That's the way God is. Your eyes are doves. He said that to her before, which we talked, dove is a symbol of peace and purity, and to look into the eyes of the beloved and find purity and peace is wonderful, instead of finding adultery or lust or hatred or whatever. The eyes are the light lamp of the soul, and the eyes kind of give you away. Now he says, your eyes are doves behind your veil. She's veiled. In the Orient, it's very customary to veil, for a woman to be veiled. The Muslims take that to great excess by covering everything except the eyes with an ugly black robe. But in the ancient Oriental culture, of which this is a story, a bride was frequently wore a veil in public. Why is that? What does that symbolize?
I guess it could be protection or ownership or something.
Oh yeah, ownership. Her beauty is only for her beloved. Her beauty isn't for the world. Her beauty isn't for other men to lust after. She's the property of her beloved, and her beauty and her intimacy belong to her husband, to her lover. So that makes sense? So that has to do with intimacy. It has to do with the kind of modesty of Eastern culture, the modesty of a man and woman reserving their intimacy for the privacy of their home and their marriage. The gardens in the Middle East are walled gardens, that you just see a plain wall on the outside of the house, but if you go inside, there's a wonderful interior court with an interior garden. Well, the interior garden is for the enjoyment of the family. It's not for the public. It's not a public garden. Well, here we have the beauty of this woman is for the king and belongs to the intimacy of their relationship. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. I don't know how women would react to that. We have to get some opinions here. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead, Mount Gilead.
That's pretty majestic. Huge herds of goats on the hill.
Shimmering. I think it's the idea of long, shimmering, beautiful hair that... waving in the wind.
I don't know if I said that to my girlfriend. She really got hung.
This doesn't exactly fit our culture very well. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them is bereaved.
No missing teeth.
Yeah, you ain't got no missing teeth and you and no fillings, and I see you had your braces did the work they're supposed to. So he's absolutely, you can see he's really caught up in what a beautiful woman she is. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate. Now, if you take the symbolism of your lips are like a scarlet thread, and you take what might be the symbolic meaning of that, of lips and speech and the tongue and...
Very smooth.
Yeah, but...
It's red.
It's like a scarlet thread. That's like... Scarlet thread through the Old Testament is the thread of redemption. What if somebody's speech is always pure? It's never inappropriate. It's gracious. That'd be a good analogy. For your lips are like scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. That might have to do with speaking and being gracious and the language and the choice of words and the things that you don't say and the whole way that you express yourself. But you remember in James how hard it is to tame the tongue. The tongue is frequently a source of gossip and maliciousness and everything. Okay? Your mouth is like that. Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate. Now, pomegranate is not a very attractive fruit. So why would you say your cheeks are like a pomegranate? Well, a pomegranate does have a nice pink skin on the outside, leathery skin. And she may be well suntanned from being a Bedouin girl. But what about the pomegranate?
Full of tiny seeds.
It's round. Round, okay. The fruit's on the inside. What happens if you peel a pomegranate? You get inside, you get this luscious, red, delicious fruit.
That's really hard to clean up.
It's hard to go. But the fruit of her beauty, the most important beauty in a woman is inside, is her inner beauty. So the pomegranate is a very good example of outward ordinary fruit, but inwardly full of this exquisite beauty and taste and red, beautiful red berries. Your neck is like a tower of David built for an arsenal, whereon hang 1,000 bucklers, all of them shields of warriors. Oh.
Sorry, no late comers, dude.
This is kind of strange to say to your girlfriend, your neck reminds me of David's tower over there that's built to hold a whole arsenal, and I know that, and in this tower there are warrior shields and weapons.
Warrior shields?
Yeah, so that doesn't sound like a very attractive neck. Except that we talked about the neck as a symbol of
the will.
The will. So what if you were going to if you were going to commend somebody for always making wise choices, your neck is like the Tower of David means self-discipline, means making many right choices day after day, year after year, being dependable, being consistent, being not yielding to temptation, not being wishy-washy or ambivalent about things. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. So that's, I think that is. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. Now the breasts symbolize something. They symbolize feeding capacity. Capacity to nurture. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. So that's a compliment. There's a compliment in the king admiring this woman for her outward appearance, obviously, but he's also interested in her spiritual growth. And she has inner beauty, and she has capacity to nurture others, and she's obviously, while he's been gone, she's matured through her lonely nights and her times away. Now, is that all right? Everybody happy? Strange language, and it's Easter. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, means it's nighttime, until morning comes in and the shadows of nighttime flee away, I'm going to the mountain of prayer and the hill of frankincense. You are all fair, my love, there's no flaw in you. Come with me to Lebanon, my bride. Come with me to Lebanon. Depart to the peak of Amana, to the peak of Senir and Hermon, to the dens of lions, to the mountains of leopards. The translations usually say from in there.
Yeah.
But that makes sense, actually.
Does it make sense, you said?
Let's see which makes sense. He says, I'm leaving right now.
Yeah.
And I am going... I'm going to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. What does myrrh stand for? What does frankincense stand for? Myrrh stands for suffering. Frankincense stands for prayer. Incense is always a picture of prayer. So he says to her, night is falling and I have something I've got to go do tonight. And what has he got to go do? He's got to go pray. And this is anguish. Pray and anguish. This is at the end of a long day with his disciples. Remember how Jesus was all day long, the people clamored after him to be healed, to be touched, have a word, and only late at night could he sometimes get away and go pray to the Father to get help and wisdom for the next day. And do you remember the Garden of Gethsemane, which was anguish for him as he prayed on the way to the cross? And this is part of his job as the king, is the suffering and the prayer and for the world. He's the leader. He's in charge of the kingdom. He's in charge. Naturally, he wants to be with his beloved. Naturally, he'd like to stay there, but he can't. So he says, come with me. And by the way, I'm going up to Lebanon. I'm going up into the high mountains. And up in the high mountains are lions and leopards. Now, do you think she's going to say, No, I'll stay at home and wait for you. How long will you be gone? No. What do you think? Why would he like to have her along? Yeah, you want your companions, the companionship of your beloved with you when you go through hard trials. Does Jesus like, would he like us to go into the place of prayer? Yes. Would he like us in the Garden of Gethsemane to comfort him and remain with him? Yes. What did the disciples do at the Garden of Gethsemane? They just went to sleep. So the part of growing up as a Christian then would be to share everything that the king is doing. But there's not only is this a dangerous nighttime journey up in the mountains, but up in the mountains we find the dens of lions and leopards, which means this is very dangerous up in the hills for anybody. And what do the lions and leopards stand for? Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, goes around like a roaring lion seeking someone he may devour. If you go up into the mountains, into the heavenly places, into prayer, into spiritual warfare, into real serious intercession, there's spiritual warfare involved. And this is beginning to take on the forces of evil and fight against the prince of darkness, the devil, and fight against him in prayer. And so this is very dangerous. And so, would you come with me, he says. Will you come with me? I'd like your companionship. I don't like to go up alone into the mountains and pray all night. I don't like to be, I'd love to have my beloved at my side praying with me, supporting me, encouraging me. I'd like to have my church involved in the things that I'm involved with at nighttime that involve suffering and prayer and sacrifice and hardship instead of staying home and being comfy cozy. But now we'll see if she goes. We'll see if she responds. Because in the next, because a period of time goes by, and the next thing we find he says to her is, you have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. You have ravished my heart with a glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. That's pretty neat. That the king is turned on by the one glance of her eyes.
So how do we know that time has passed between...
Well, let's see in a minute here. Okay. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips distill nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your garments is like the scent of Lebanon. How would she get her garments smelling like the pine forests of Lebanon?
She took them in the wood that was...
So she went up into the mountains of Lebanon with him. Well, now, something's very interesting here, too, because why was it that she was first interested in following him? She heard about him, and something that she found attractive drew her to this relationship. And she noted right away there were two things about him that she wanted and that he had. His love was better than wine. His fragrant oils were better than incense. That's what she wanted. That the love that he offered was better than the love the world would offer. That the joys, the life that he would offer would be better than anything you could find in the world. Now he says that to her. What's gone on here? He says...
Change perspective or something?
He says, how sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. The king says that about her. It's not how the story started. What happens when you grow in Christ? What happens when you get mature? You become Christ-like. So you have the love that you are able to love the way that Jesus loved you. You are able to give with the same way that he gave to you. You are a fragrance to people around you. It would be a really lousy relationship if the woman was always needy and ugly and helpless and stayed at home all the time and didn't get anywhere. She would not be very interesting to the king, and she'd never grow up, and it would never be a very evenly matched marriage, because he would be the one that did all the work and she didn't do anything. But that's not the way the Song of Solomon works at all. At the Song of Solomon, at every step, the woman is an equal lover. Every time he comes home, he's amazed because she's grown. And he appreciates her love. Now, if you go to an ordinary wedding, you know, on an ordinary wedding day, the groom is up there with a penguin suit on, and he's nobody, and he doesn't matter much. And then this bride comes in with magnificent gown and beautiful girls escorting her and flowers and music, and she goes down the aisle, and it's her day. And she's got all the beauty, and he's got nothing. That's the way it is. Well, now, of course, with Jesus, it's exactly the opposite, because we don't have anything, and he has everything. But what kind of a wedding would it be if one of the partners had all the assets and the other one had nothing? It would not be a very good relationship. Well, in the Song of Solomon, the relationship between the king and the queen is always matched. So she's always growing. So he says, I want you to grow. I want you to come up in the mountains and suffer, and it's dangerous, but will you go? And she says, yes, I'm scared to death, but I will go. So she goes and grows and comes home with the fragrance of Lebanon. And he's thrilled that she's taken that big step of faith and grown and moved on. So she has responded to his call. And that means that when we obey God, we take another step forward in our growth. And he enjoys our love at every step of the way. And we're always matched. So now he sees in her the things that originally were that she saw in him. That's kind of neat. So that means that the church is growing up to be a beautiful bride, suitable for the Lord, and we are the bride, which is pretty amazing that we should end up at the wedding day as the bride of Christ. Without spot or blemish, and go to a great wedding supper and have the groom show us off as his beautiful bride. The church as the bride of Christ. Can you see that? A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. Which says... This is beautiful imagery that a garden locked is my sister. If a garden is locked, then strangers aren't welcome there. The beauty of your spouse is not for the world. It's not to be advertised. You know, prostitutes put on seductive clothing and parade down Main Street and offer their wares to anybody. But the bride is discreet and modest, and her beauty belongs to her husband. The beauty of the church is an inner beauty. Our beauty, the beauty of our lives, is inward beauty. The garden locked, the fountain sealed. All those are little pictures of the Garden of Eden, and also pictures of the woman's nurturing. Women conceive and bring children into the world and nurture and heal and provide shelter and all those. And all that inner beauty is symbolized by a walled garden block. With a fountain seal, that means that this is a holy relationship and it's not to be violated. Your shoots are like an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all chief spices, a garden, fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Now we're back down to the palace. We're back down to the royal palace, which she has built. They've come down out of the mountains from Lebanon. Now they're in the palace, and while the king's been gone, guess what she does? What does she do when he's out of town and he's busy? She is busy growing a garden. And the garden is for her lover's delight. And the garden is full of the fruits of the Spirit. It's full of all manner of choice flowers and fruits and spices, frankincense and myrrh and aloe, all spices. So it's an exotic garden. And it has a great fountain in the middle to water it. And it's a walled garden in the middle of a desert land. And flowing streams from Lebanon. The flowing streams from Lebanon, that all the spiritual life, the spiritual life that flows because you underwent the spiritual warfare of Lebanon, went up in the mountains and prayed and conquered the dens of lions and leopards. So, the first time, the first garden that we had, she was kind of neglecting. And he had to tell her, hey, look out the window, it's not winter anymore, and the garden is starting to sprout, and catch us the little foxes that spoil the vineyards. Well, now, all on her own, she's got this great garden. Which is sort of like, can you be fruitful in your Christian life, independent of others and whether they're fruitful? Can you keep your relationship with Jesus going, whether you feel close to him or not, and in all seasons of the year? Are you becoming, are you growing the fruit of the Spirit inside? That's the idea here. So there's this fruit. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, and blow upon my garden. Let its fragrance be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits, she says. She speaks to the north wind and to the south wind, and she says, take the fragrance of all the spices and the flowers from the garden and carry them to the winds of the earth. And then, oh, I hope my beloved comes soon to his garden to eat his choicest fruits. But why would the fragrance, why would she like to have the fragrance of the garden spread over the world? But it's a private garden. It belongs to the king.
That'd be like trying to call him back. Like, smell me, I'm good.
Come back from yes, me. But also, he will come back. But what else does it do? 2 Corinthians. We are a fragrance, the fragrance of Christ, from life unto life and death unto death. The fragrance of Jesus is in our lives, and it is automatically there all the time, and it's carried around invisibly. And that means that everybody that we meet responds to the fragrance of the presence of Jesus in our lives. To one group of people, it's a fragrance that's attractive and draws people to us, and mostly draws people to the Lord. To another group of people, it's a fragrance of death and turns them away. That's the fragrance of the garden. And the longer you've known the Lord, you're around a real wonderful, mature Christian. They have a fragrance about them, that you feel the weightiness of their lives and the beauty of their lives, and it's attractive. But the garden is still the private property of the Lord. The garden of your heart belongs to Jesus. It doesn't belong to anybody else. So you have to guard the integrity of that relationship. Relationship with Jesus comes number one before any other relationship. This chapter closes, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. He comes in next chapter 5. There shouldn't be a chapter division. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink deeply, O lovers. That's like the companion speaking there. So the king comes to the garden. Does the king enjoy the relationship which has now begun, say, some years ago. Yes, he does. Does he want to come? Does he come and take delight in the garden and the relationship? Yes, he does. Never gets old. It makes you think about it. It says, think about how God sees our relationship. Does he see us as full of thorns and weeds and cranky and ornery and full of thistles and an untended garden? Or does he see us as having attractive hearts and attractive minds and a place that he'd like to come and visit? That's the whole idea here. So there we have these cycles then of ever-growing intimacy, and then we have these times apart, and during the times apart there's suffering, and there's prayer, and there's hardship, and there's also times for creative growth, whether the couple is together or not. Whether you feel close to the Lord, you can still be praying and reading the Bible and serving God, and you may feel far, 1,000 miles away from Him. But when He comes back, there'll be a difference. Or is everybody all hopelessly skeptical? He leaves again. Leaves a long time. Gone away. Gone away on a foreign mission. This happened before, only now it's worse. I slept, but my heart was awake, she says. Hark, my beloved is knocking, middle of the night. And he says, open to me, my sister, my love. Notice he says sister, that's an intimate kind of thing. She's really a dear, intimate friend as well as lover. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. My head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. Comes in the middle of the night. He's wet from the dew and the mist. He's on a very urgent journey. And he says, open to me, open the door, open the door. And she says, I had put off my garment, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh upon the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. Now, what's going on here in Christian and spiritual life? Very comfortable in the palace.
To become open to deception or something like that? Some very false...
What's that?
To become open to deception, maybe, or...
Well, he shows up in the middle of the night, unexpectedly. And wants to be let in. And then what does she do? Does she run up and open the door? No, she doesn't. What'd she do?
She's skeptical.
She just doesn't want to put her robe back on.
Yeah. Oh, I just took a shower. I've just gone to bed now. This is not convenient at all. And what does he want me to do? I just wash my feet, and if I go out after him, I'll get dirty and muddy in the garden. And she hesitates and falters, and when she finally gets up to answer the door, he's gone. Therefore, he was on a real, real urgent trip, and he didn't have any time to wait, and he wanted her to get up and jump up right then and there and follow him. And she said, let me think about it. And then when it was time to respond, he was gone. Now, what does that correspond with in our lives? Tell me about how that fits real life.
Christ wants us to do things now.
Yeah.
He does, and we're going, oh, well, I'm too busy.
Yeah. That's, is that sort of fit? This is not convenient. Call me again. Call me in the morning. I'm sleepy, or I got homework to do, or this is not what? It's raining out. So if Jesus Jesus from time to time interrupts the routine of our lives and asks us to do something that's hard or challenging or difficult, and he'd like instant obedience. He'd like us to recognize his voice and jump. And especially if it's an urgent mission, he doesn't have time to sit around and explain it. So he's in some kind of a dangerous warfare situation or a dangerous situation, and he wants the companionship of his bride. And on past dangerous times, she's gone with him to Lebanon and up into the mountains of Dan. But his head is wet with dew, his locks with the drops of the night. So it's nighttime. It's dangerous. It's urgent. He has only just time to rush by and knock on the door and say, "Come with me, come with me." And she finally gets up and opens the door. By that time, he can't wait any longer, and he's gone. So that would mean that we have to be alert for the times in our lives when Jesus says, I need you right now. I need to interrupt your comfortable, convenient life, and I need you to go do something. Now, not every voice that says, come and do something, is a legitimate call. Because sometimes your friends will take advantage of you. But at any rate, in this situation, she opens the door and he had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I saw him but found him not. I called him but he gave no answer. So she runs out the door into the cold night and he's nowhere to be seen. Now she's really panicked. Uh-oh, I've really failed him this time. I called him, but he gave no answer. Now she goes out in the city. Now this is really, he wanted me to follow him, and I haven't followed him, and I have totally failed. And where is he? And he wanted me to go away with him forever, and I've blown it. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchman found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than any other beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than any other beloved that you thus adjure us? Now, what's going on? Another sick with love episode. She runs out in Jerusalem. This is the queen running out in Jerusalem. And what about the watchman on the walls? This woman has lost her mind. She's having a panic attack. They give her some pretty rough treatment. They beat me, they wounded me, they took away my mantle. And she begins to realize that she shouldn't have, that she's handled this whole thing wrong, and she's kind of ruining her testimony around Jerusalem pretty badly, because for the queen to get up and run around in the middle of the night with a nightgown on and get all the guards alarmed and wake up the whole city, is not exactly appropriate. And so the daughters of Jerusalem now say, how's the reaction of the daughters of Jerusalem? Remember, they're younger, they're less mature. What do they say?
What's the difference between, wait, you're following anybody else out there?
Yeah, your lover isn't the guy, is evidently a jerk. Nobody, who is this king that you've been trying to get us interested in? Who is this Jesus that you've been telling us about? Boy, he must not be what you said he is. So why have you been trying to get us interested in him? Look at the way you behave in a difficult situation. Look how you've come apart. Your life has come apart at the seams just because he isn't here in town. Do you get it? So this is another form of lovesickness. Would be an emotional overreaction. That was her failure to obey immediately caused her to get totally distraught. She ran out in the streets. Rather than collecting her thoughts, if she'd stayed home and prayed and realized she'd blown it, that'd be okay. But she didn't. She runs out and tells everybody in the city that the king is missing. Well, everybody knows the king's gone. Nope, she's the only one that knows that he came knocking on the door in the night and left again. And he wanted her, he didn't want the whole town. And now there's a big commotion in the city, and the daughters of Jerusalem are saying, ha, this king of yours is a real jerk, evidently. He's not important. And then she says, oh my gosh, I've blown it. Daughters of Jerusalem, she even asks the daughters of Jerusalem if they can find him. If you find my beloved, tell him I'm sick with love. If you find my beloved, tell him I'm sick with love. Well, she ought to know more about her beloved than they do. So that's why they say, who is this beloved more than any other beloved? Oh, fairest among women, that's all full of mocking. Who is this beloved more than any other beloved that you tell us this? Now, this is where she gets her composure back. Suddenly she comes back to her senses. And she realizes that the world is looking at her life, that she is the beloved of the king, that she represents Jesus, that everybody is watching her life, that all kinds of non-Christians and lukewarm Christians are looking at her example, and she is the one that should know more about the king than any of them. So now look what she does. Look how she handles this. Gets her composure back, and she makes this speech. Listen to this speech here. My beloved is all radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. That's where we get the old hymn, he's the fairest and 10,000 of the fair. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk fitly set. His cheeks are like the beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies distilling liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is ivory work, encrusted with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns, set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His speech is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And they say, where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. All right, how's that for regathering your composure when you've had a really bad time? And the king is still gone. And she suddenly gets up and says, oh my gosh, my relationship with the king is still intact. He hasn't left me. And these people are watching me, and now look at how she describes, what is this, how does she describe the king now, who's not there? Radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000, she should know. Head of the finest gold deity, locks of great black hair, eyes like doves, cheeks like beds of spices, all this poetic imagery of a great man, a great king, a great soldier, a great warrior, a great lover, legs like alabaster columns, that's strength and manhood. His appearance is like Lebanon. How would she know that if she hadn't been to Lebanon? Choice is the cedars, the great cedar trees of Lebanon. And his speech is most pleasant. And this is my beloved. And then she adds on, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Remember in the New Testament, Jesus said, no longer do I call you servants. A servant does not know what his master is doing, but from now on, from henceforth, I will call you friends. that intimacy with Jesus. We have intimacy with Jesus that is unknown in the Old Testament. So that is, now this is the most powerful image of the man we've seen so far, with all of this poetic descriptions of his characteristics of leadership and of bravery and of courage and of masculinity and of being the rightful king. And does this work? Yes, it turns the whole situation around, because the daughters of Jerusalem say, oh, now we understand. Where is the king? Well, maybe we should be following him after all, the way you are. Maybe we ought to go seek the relationship with him that you have. And she knows where he is, and she says, she knows where he is, really, and where is he? Well, he's gone a long time, but my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices. He's out taking care of his gardens. He's out taking care of his flocks. I belong to my beloved, and my beloved is mine, so the fact that he's away from home doesn't bother me very much anymore. I have plenty of things to do. And by the way, my first question to him was where he pastures his flock, and now she says, now she knows where he pastures his flock. Among the lilies. And the lilies are the believers who are wholeheartedly serving him, and compared to the thorns. Okay? Emotional overload of any kind, and fear and panic come to all of us, whether we're men or women. And doubt and anxiety and not feeling close to God. And in those times we can make bad decisions, and we can sort of forget about God, and he hasn't forgotten about us. Then the Song of Solomon is all about that. It's all about the relationship between the king and the queen is actually growing. But it's growing with trials and hardships and suffering and testing. He comes back. You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love. Tirzah city, a small, beautiful city in northern Israel. You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my love, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. He says that to this young woman. You are terrible as an army with banners. Wow, what a prize you are. That's a supreme compliment. Now look at this one. Turn away your eyes from me, for they disturb me. Wow. that. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. We had that before. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All among them bear twins. Not one of them is bereaved. Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. We had that before. So this woman has stature. She has maturity. She's loving and caring and incredibly beautiful with her inner beauty. And now there's a surprise. This time there's a surprise when the king comes home. He looks in amazement and says, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. Oh, what's been going on in Jerusalem since I've been gone? You've been having Bible studies, I see. Some of those daughters of Jerusalem have apparently decided to move on into the kind of intimacy that you and I have. And who are these 80 concubines here that you've recruited for the beginner's inquiring Bible study? Well, that is fantastic, he says. And maidens without number, why, you've been evangelizing the whole town here. You've got all these people interested in me. Why, that's fantastic. And then he says to her,
you're the only one that really matters.
That's right. My dove, my perfect one, is only one. The only one, the darling of her mother, flawless to her that bore her. The maidens saw her and called her happy, the queens and the concubines also, and they praised her. Who is this who looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? Now, that's something really important here. And that is that Jesus has a unique love relationship with each one of us that is unaffected by the fact that he has a unique love relationship with everybody else that knows him. Which in the real world would be adultery. So it does not matter how many people Jesus has an intimate personal relationship with. His relationship with you is intimate and unique and personal and never loses that. So that's the point here. The point being that if all of us had the same relationship that the queen has here with the king, that doesn't in no way dilutes the uniqueness of the and intensity of that love. So we are all, and that's the thing about God. God doesn't just love us in general. He loves us for who we are as individuals, and every one of us is different, and every one of us is unique, and he loves us for who we are, and he wants us each to grow up and be fulfilled in our own attributes and our own gifts, one by one by one. And not only that, so it's wonderful that many others would like this same relationship, and the daughters of Jerusalem look up to her as she's the mentor, she's the one that's taught them. How do you feel if a brother or sister gets really turned on by the Lord, and maybe comes out of a lackluster Christian life into really giving himself or herself to the Lord? How do you feel about it? Well, you're always happy with that. It was thrilled, right? Doesn't threaten your relationship with the Lord, does it? Not in the least. Doesn't mean that God loves you less at all. So that's the idea. And now, this is a real interesting description. Who is this who looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? That's to call your girlfriend that. To call a woman terrible as an army with banners.
Okay, I'm kind of confused because my translation says majestic, and that's kind of...
Yeah, that's even better. Majestic is good, yeah.
Mine says awesome.
Awesome, yeah.
Is it right?
Yeah, that's good. Majestic or awesome, yeah. Formidable. Stately. This is a queen of... A woman of stature and integrity and beauty. And no man can stand up to her she's a match for anybody, and yet she has all the graciousness and poise of a woman of God.
In other words, she could kick a lot of butt.
Yeah, if necessary. So this, by the way, is one of the old figures of the church. The church is like the moon. The church shines dimly, reflecting the light of Jesus the Son. In the absence of, at nighttime, when the sun is set, the church reflects the light of Jesus until he comes back. The church inwardly the church is a bride, but outwardly the church is an army with banners. So there's a kind of secret of masculinity and femininity. Femininity is the receptive side. It's the receptive inner side of our church life in which Jesus is our lover and our leader, and he fills us with himself. And if Jesus fills the church with himself, then outwardly we see this, the church becomes an army, an unstoppable army. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? We'll stop there. Well, I missed a whole bunch, didn't I?
Yeah.
I missed. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as be upon a dance before two armies? Verse 11 is later on. There's a time lapse. And the queen says, today I'm going down to my nut orchard. I'm going to go down to the blossoms in the valley, and I'm going to go check upon the vines and the pomegranates. And while she's down there, a chariot swoops down and takes her away. Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince and the daughters of Jerusalem, and miss her immediately. And? So what might that be?
So she's doing the thing that she's doing, or being involved with her ministry, or whatever.
Yeah.
And she's suddenly visited by the king again.
And he takes her home. I think that's possible. It's hard to read that there, but I think that's... But look at her now. Look at her daily life. Whether the king is there or not, she's busy taking care of the orchards and the nut trees and the vines. She has her own vineyard, by the way, now.
Yes.
And the king might be gone for a year, but in the meantime, she's going to be busy being fruitful and planting orchards and gardens. Not just her garden, but gardens all over the place. And she loves to do that. And she's checking the vines. So the all this maturity has come up in her life. Things that she was scared of, she handles confidently now. She doesn't have to be asked or called. She does them on her own initiative. Okay? Now, where are people really hung up here with this strange poetic language? It's subjective. The book speaks to every person individually, and it each speaks differently to every one of us because we're all in a different place in life. And so I'm giving you my what it says to me, which doesn't have to be what it says to you. If you get the idea, this is about relationships. It's about the differences between men and women. It has very much to do with our unique, with our individual relationships with Jesus, whether we are male or female. It has to do with that. It has to do a lot with emotions and our responses and our obedience and our prayer life and our spiritual fruitfulness and our... Is our relationship with Jesus growing? Is it growing in intimacy? Is that a personal relationship? All those things. And then the big difference between a woman's view of the world and a man's view of the world, but we can understand both in here. So that's why, so Solomon and Shulamite are from the Hebrew word, both of those are from the Hebrew word shalom, which means wholeness. So you are both the king and the queen in one sense of the word. You are both the king and the queen in the Song of Solomon. When you act in the name of Jesus and you go in the name of Jesus in the world, then you're acting in the man's role and the battlefront and the forefront and the leadership place. And in our private life, we're contemplative and prayerful and fruitful. And everything in between. And the relationship between the man and the woman grows throughout the whole book. She starts with nothing and she ends up with everything that he has. And he loves her from the day they meet, but he never stops loving her and she never stops growing. So they have a wonderful relationship that never gets old. Like somebody, a dear married couple that's been around for 50 years and like two lovebirds still. Was that awful? Did I ruin it? No. Father, thank you for this difficult book of Hebrew poetry and the fact that it's very personal and that this book is part of the Word of God and it speaks to every one of us individually. And that you're ready by the Spirit to apply parts of this book to us, each one of us today, and help us to see ourselves in the mirror of this Word of God and the mirror of this love story. And I pray that we might learn to love you as a person and learn to enjoy you as a friend and somebody that's very interested in us and is a God who takes delight in us and enjoys a relationship with us and helps us with our insecurities and fears and it helps us through all of the rough times in life and guarantees the end result. And I pray, Father, that we could all learn to be responsive and obedient and to cultivate our relationship with you and to be willing to obey and to respond, and that the fragrance of our lives would spread abroad to reach many, and that many would be drawn to the Lord. And just thanks for our time together, and please watch over our lives and protect us and guard us. Separate us from the world and make us into the beautiful walled gardens, that places where our fellowship with you is very sweet and very dear and very personal. In the name of Jesus. Well, we can finish this next week, God willing, and you can all do home finals.